just last night, one we are still recovering from. I did hear rumor of that, sir.
Gregor smiled at him. He kept smiling, showing all of his large white teeth, while the bald man glowered back.
Fine,
said the bald man, exasperated.
Fine, fine.
He sat forward and rang a bell. The door behind him opened, and a young man of about 12, dressed in Dandolo house colors, popped out. The bald man opened his mouth, but struggled with what to say. He gestured to Gregor, then at the door, and, seeming to surrender, wearily said,
You see?
The boy nodded and ducked back into the doorway. They waited. The bald man glared at Gregor. Gregor smiled back at the bald man. Then, after what felt like hours, the boy popped back out again.
She will see you, Founder, he said, his voice low and passive, the tone of someone used to being spoken over.
Thank you, said Gregor.
He bowed to the man and followed the boy into the sanctum beyond. To be the descendant of a merchant house founder was to wield an almost incomprehensible degree of wealth, power, and resources in Tavan. One of the Morsini sons only took meetings in his private gardens while mounted atop a giraffe bedecked in a jeweled saddle cover and bridle. Tribuno Candiano's sister had apparently had a silk dress designed for each day of the year. Each gown was labored over by dozens of seamstresses, worn once, and then promptly disposed of. So it was probably inevitable that Ophelia Dandolo, as not only of founder lineage, but also head of the house itself, was a supremely impressive person. But what Gregor found most impressive about his mother was that she actually worked. She was not like Torino Morsini, head of Morsini House, who was hugely fat and often hugely drunk, and usually spent his time trying to stuff his aged candle into every nubile girl on his campo. Nor was she like Eferizo Michiel, who had retired from the burdensome life of responsibility to pass his days painting portraits, landscapes, and nudes. Quite a lot of nudes, actually, Gregor had heard, chiefly of young men. No, Ophelia Dandolo passed her days, and indeed most of her nights, behind desks. She read and wrote letters behind desks, sat through meetings behind desks, and listened to her countless advisors prattle on and on from behind desks. And since that madness in Foundry Side and the Greens last night, Gregor was not at all surprised to find her seated behind her desk in her personal office, reviewing reports. She did not look up as he walked in. He stood before her, hands clasped behind his back, and waited for her to finish. He eyed her as she read a report. She was wearing evening attire, and her face was painted in an ornate pattern, with a red bar across her eyes and blue curls emanating from her blue lips. Her hair was also done up in an elaborate bun. He suspected she'd received news of the Foundry Side blackout during a party of some sort, and had been working ever since. She was still grand and beautiful and strong, but she was also looking her age, he thought. Perhaps it was the job. She'd taken over for the merchant house after Gregor's father had died in the carriage accident, and that had been, what, 23 years ago? 24? He'd assumed she'd eventually start relinquishing duties, but his mother had not. Instead, she'd taken on more and more responsibilities until she practically was Dandolo Chartered, and all of its policies and decisions emanated solely from her person. 10 years of that would kill a normal person. Ophelia Dandolo had managed 2 decades, but he wasn't sure she had a full third in her.
Your brow is damp, she said quietly, without looking up.
Pardon?
He said, surprised.
Your brow is damp, my dear.
She scratched out a response to the report and set it aside.
With sweat, I assume.
You must have walked a long way. I will assume you refused a carriage from all the house guards again.
I did.
She looked at him, and a lesser person would have winced. Ophelia Dandolo's amber eyes shone bright against her dark skin, and they had the curious power of making her will feel almost palpable. A glare from her felt like a slap. And I will assume you took smug delight in confusing and disappointing them? Gregor opened his mouth, unsure what to say. Oh, never mind, she said, setting her report aside. She looked him over. I hope, Gregor, that you've come to offer aid to your Campo. I hope that you heard about the disasters in Foundry Side, about how all the scrivings failed in what seems to have been a half-mile radius across the commons, and came straight here to see how you could assist. I hope these things, but I do not expect these things, because I doubt if even this disaster could make you come back to us, Gregor.
Was Dandolo chartered really affected by the blackout?
She laughed slowly. Was it affected? A foundry lexicon failed in the Spinola site, right next to the Greens. We were lucky we had two others in the region to keep everything running smoothly. Otherwise, things would have graduated from disaster to outright catastrophe. This was startling. A foundry lexicon was an intricate, bafflingly complicated, and stupendously expensive device that essentially made all scribed devices work on the Campo. Do you suspect sabotage? Possibly, she said reluctantly. Yet, whatever happened to us also hit the Michiel Campo bordering Foundry Side. It doesn't seem to have discriminated much. But you're not really here to talk about that, are you, Gregor?
No, Mother, he said. I'm afraid I am not.
Then, what are you interrupting me for at this worst of all moments?
The fire.
At first, she looked surprised, then furious. Really?
Really,
he said. Our entire civilization has just been gravely threatened, she said. And yet you want to talk about your little project? About resuscitating your municipal militia?
City police,
said Gregor quickly. She sighed.
Ah, Gregor, I know you were worried the fire had ruined your project, but trust me, that's the last thing on everyone's minds right now. Everyone's probably forgotten all about it. I know I did. I wanted to make you aware, Mother, said Gregor, stung, that I believe I am mere moments away from catching the saboteur that set the fire. I was in the commons last night.
Her mouth fell open. You were in the commons? Last night? When?
Yes, when all hell broke loose. I was making inquiries at the time, and was quite successful, if I might say so. I have located the thief, and will almost certainly capture them tonight. When I do so, I would like to bring them before the Tavani Council.
Ah, she said, you want a big, showy public trial to clear your name.
To make it clear that the Water Watch project is sustainable, said Gregor.
Yes, so, if you would begin clearing the way for that process. She smirked. I thought, my dear, that you didn't like using your family access, she said. This was true. His mother was one of the major committee chairs for the Council of Tavan. The council was entirely populated by merchant house elites, and generally ensured that the houses didn't excessively sabotage or plagiarize one another, though the definition of excessively was getting more nebulous these days. It was the closest thing the city of Tavan had to a real government, though in Gregor's opinion, it was not that close at all. As such, Gregor could have used his mother's position to press all kinds of advantages, yet he'd always refrained thus far. But not today.
"If it is to advance the greater good of Tavan," said Gregor, "then I will use any means necessary."
"Yes, yes, Gregor Dandolo, friend of the common man," she sighed. "Odd that your solution is to start chucking so many common men in jail."
Gregor's natural response would have been, "It is not just common men that I wish to jail."
But he wasn't so stupid as to come out and say that. She considered it. A handful of moths flitted down out of the ceiling to rotate around her head in a drunken halo. She waved a hand at them. "Shoo now, damn things! We can't even keep our offices clean." She glared at Gregor.
"Fine. I will initiate the proceedings. But the blackout takes precedence. Once that's resolved, we will move on to your water watches and your thieves and scoundrels. All right?"
"And how long will that take?"
"How in the hell should I know, Gregor?" she snapped. "We don't even know what happened, let alone what to do next."
"I see," he said.
"Are you satisfied?" she asked, picking up her quill.
"Almost," he said.
"I had one last request."
She sighed and put her quill back down.
"Would it be possible for me to consult with the Dandolo Hippotas?" he said. "I had some questions I wanted to ask him."
She stared at him.
With Orso?" she said, incredulous. "Whatever do you want to do that for?"
"I had some scribing questions related to the theft."
But you could go to any scriver for that."
"I could go to 10 different scrivers and get 10 different answers," said Gregor.
"Or I could go to the smartest scriver in Tavan and get the right one."
"At the moment, I doubt if he could give it to you," said Ophelia.
"Not only is he occupied with the blackout, but I've recently come to wonder if he's even more insane than I'd previously thought."
That piqued Gregor's interest.
"Oh, why would that be, Mother?"
She seemed to debate whether to answer, then sighed.
"Because he's screwed up, considerably. When they found the ruins in Vialto, Orso lobbied me heavily to try to secure some of the items before they were snatched up by our competitors. I consented, reluctantly, and Orso did his utmost to acquire one curious relic. It was an old, cracked stone box, but it had some similarities to a lexicon. Orso spent a fortune getting it, but then, while in transit between Vialto and here, it vanished."
"It was lost at sea?" said Gregor. "Or was it stolen?"
"No one can say," said Ophelia. "But the loss was significant. I have seen the numbers in the balance books. They are large and not positive. I forbade any future efforts."
"He didn't take it well."
"So, Orso Ignacio might have been robbed before," thought Gregor. He made a note of it. "If you really want to talk to Orso Ignacio," she said, "you'll need to go to the Spinola Foundry, the one bordering the Greens. That's where the lexicon failed, so that, of course, is where Orso is, trying to figure out what the hell happened."
She looked at him sharply. Gregor suppressed a wince at the sight of it.
"I know I can't tell you what to do, Gregor. You've always made that clear. But I strongly suggest you consider going elsewhere with your questions. Orso is not someone to trifle with. And after the blackouts, I've no doubt he'll be in the foulest of foul moods."
He smiled politely.
I have dealt with worse people, he said. I believe I can handle myself, Mother.
She smiled. I'm sure you think so.
Son of a scrumming bitch!
Echoed the voice up the stairs.
Son of a worthless, toothless, shitting whore!
Gregor paused at the top of the Spinola Foundry stairs and glanced at the foundry guard, who gave him a nervous shrug. The voice continued screaming.
What do you mean you think the records are accurate? How do you shitting think records are accurate? Accuracy is a binary scrumming state. They either are accurate or they are not.
These last two words were screamed so loud, they genuinely hurt Gregor's ears, even from here.
Are you married, man? Do you have children? If so, I'm stunned. I'm just flummoxed, because I'd have thought you were so damn stupid you wouldn't know how to stick your candle in your wife. Maybe check around and see if there are any other slack-jawed idiots about with a strong resemblance to your grubby spawn. I swear to God, if you aren't back here in 1 hour with records that are genuinely, unimpeachably, undeniably accurate, I'll personally paint your balls with fig jelly and toss you stark naked into a hog pit. Now get out of my goddamn sight!
There was the sound of frantic footfalls below, then silence.
It's been like that all morning, said the foundry guard quietly. I'd have thought his voice would have given out by now.
I see, said Gregor. Thank you.
He started off down the stairs to the lexicon chamber below. The stairs went down and down and down into the dark. As Gregor descended, things began to feel different. They felt heavier, slower, denser, like he was walking not through dank, musty air, but was instead at the bottom of the sea, with miles and miles of water pressing down on him.
How I hate getting near lexicons, thought Gregor.
Like most people, Gregor did not understand the mechanics of scrying. He could not tell one sigillum from another. In fact, he couldn't even differentiate one house's scrying language from another, which was even more fundamental. But he knew how scrying worked in broad terms. The basic sigillums were symbols that naturally occurred within the world. No one knew exactly where the base sigils came from. Some said the Occidentals had invented them. Others said that the symbols were written into the world by the Creator, by God himself, that he had defined reality by encoding it with these sigillums, forging the world much as the foundries forged scribed rigs. No one was sure. Each basic sigillum referenced specific things. There were symbols for stone, wind, air, fire, growth, leaves, and even ones for more abstract phenomena, for change or stop or start or sharp. There were millions, if not billions, of them. If you knew these symbols, though few did, then there was nothing stopping you from using them. Even in the most primitive settlement out in the middle of nowhere, if you were trying to carve wood into some intricate shape, you could inscribe it with the base sigil for clay or mud. And this tiny alteration would make the wood slightly, slightly more malleable. But despite all the legends around its origins, basic scrying was very restricted. To start with, its effects were minor, no more than a slight nudge. But worse, if you wanted to tell an axe, you are very durable, very sharp, very light, and you part the wood of the cedar tree as if it were water. Something much more complicated than just sharp or hard, in other words. Such a command would be 50 or 60 sigils long. You'd run out of room on the axe blade, and you'd also have to get the sigil logic just right so the axe blade would understand what it was supposed to be. You had to be specific and definite, and this was hard. But then, the city of Tavan had discovered an old cache of Occidental records in a cave down the coast. and in those records, they'd discovered something crucial. The sigil for meaning. And then some cunning Tavani had gotten a brilliant idea. They'd figured out that you could take a blank slate of iron, write out that extensive, complicated scribing command. But then, you could follow it with the sigil for meaning, and next write a completely new sigil, one you yourself just made up. Then that new sigil would essentially mean you are very durable, very sharp, very light, and you part the wood of the cedar tree as if it were water. And then you'd just have to write that one sigil on your axe blade. Or on a dozen blades, or 1,000, it didn't matter. Every blade would do the same thing. After that discovery, much more complicated scribing commands were suddenly possible. Yet even this was still quite limited. For one thing, you had to stay close to whichever slate of iron had the commands written on it. If you walked too far away, then the axe blade essentially forgot what that new sigil was supposed to mean, and it stopped working. It no longer had a reference point in a way. The other problem was that if you wrote too many complicated scribing definitions on one slate of metal, it had a tendency to burst into flames. A common object, such as an iron plate, it seemed, could only bear so much meaning. So the city of Tavan and its many nascent scribing houses then had a problem to solve. How were they to house all the definitions and meanings for these complicated scribings without having everything burst into flames and melt? Which was why they'd invented lexicons. Lexicons were huge, complicated, durable machines built to store and maintain thousands and thousands of incredibly complex scribing definitions and bear the burden of all of that concentrated meaning. With a lexicon, you didn't have to worry about wandering a dozen feet too far and suddenly having all your scribed devices fail on you. Lexicons could amplify and project the meaning of those definitions for great distances in all directions, enough to cover part of a campo, if not more. The closer you were to a lexicon, though, the better your scribings worked, which was why a lexicon was always the beating heart of any foundry. You wanted all of your biggest, most intricate rigs to work at peak efficiency. And since lexicons were the beating heart of foundries, they were, in effect, the beating heart of all of Tavan. But they were complicated. Incredibly complicated. Astoundingly complicated. Only geniuses and madmen, everyone agreed, could truly understand a lexicon. And the difference between the two was almost nil. So it probably said something that, out of all the Hypati in the entire history of Tavan, Orso Ignacio understood lexicons better than anybody. After all, Orso had been the one to invent the combat lexicon, a smaller version of the regular kind, which ships and teams of oxen could haul around. That device was still quite large, complicated, and improbably expensive, and it could only manage to power a cohort's armaments. But without that contribution, Tavan would have never captured the Durazzo Sea and all the cities around it. Gregor knew quite a bit about combat lexicons. He'd had one at the Siege of Dantua, right up until he didn't. So he also knew quite a bit about what it was like to lose a lexicon. And he thought he could understand how Orso Ignacio felt right now. Perhaps he would be able to work the man from that angle. He found himself promptly disabused of these notions when he entered the lexicon chamber and instantly heard the words, "Who the shit are you?" Gregor blinked in the dim light while his eyes adjusted. The lexicon chamber was wide, dark, and mostly empty. There was a thick glass wall at the back with an open door set in its center, and a tall, thin man stood in the doorway, staring at Gregor. He wore a thick apron, thick gloves, and a pair of thick, dark goggles. He held in his hands a threatening-looking tool, some kind of bendy, looped metal wand with a lot of sharp teeth.
Pardon?
Said Gregor. The man tossed the wand away, lifted his goggles, and a pair of pale, deep-set, harsh eyes stared at him.
I said, who the shit are you?
Asked Orso Ignacio, this time much louder. Orso had the look of an artist or sculptor who'd just stepped away from his studio, wearing a stained beige shirt and off-white hose under his apron, and his beaked shoes, customary for the highest echelons, were ratty and had holes in the toes. His white hair rose up in a wild, unkempt shock, and his once handsome face was dark and lined and skeletally thin, as if the man had sat for too long in a fish curer's shed. Gregor cleared his throat.
I apologize. Good morning, Hippotas. I'm terribly sorry to interrupt you during this most
Orso rolled his eyes and looked across the room.
Who is he?
Gregor peered through the shadows and saw that there was someone else at the back of the room. Someone he'd missed. A tall, rather pretty girl, with a still, closed face. She was sitting on the floor before a tray of scribing blocks, an abacus-like device that scribers use to test scribing strings, and she was popping the blocks in and out with a frightening speed, like a professional Scivoli player moving their pieces around the board, creating a steady clack-clack-clack sound. The girl paused and glanced at Gregor, her face immaculately inscrutable.
I believe, she said in a quiet, even voice, that is Captain Gregor Dandolo.
Gregor frowned at her, surprised. He'd never met this girl in his life. The girl calmly resumed slotting the blocks in and out of the tray.
Oh, said Orso. Ophelia's boy?
He peered at Gregor.
My God, you've gained weight.
The girl, Gregor suspected she was Orso's assistant of some kind, cringed ever so slightly. But Gregor was not insulted. The last time Orso had glimpsed him, he'd probably just returned from the wars.
Yes, said Gregor. That tends to happen when a person goes from a place that has no food at all to a place that has some.
Fascinating, said Orso. So what the hell are you doing down here, Captain?
Yes,
You're still slumming it down at the waterfront, right?
His eyes suddenly burned with a strange fury.
If there is still a waterfront to slum in, that is.
Yes, and in fact,
Well, as you may notice, Captain.
He held his hands out and gestured to the large, dark, empty room.
Our current environs are bereft of waters, as well as fronts of all kinds. Not much for you to do here, it seems. Got plenty of doors, though. Loads of them.
Orso turned to examine something behind him.
I advise you scrumming make use of one. Anyone, I frankly don't care.
Gregor strode forward into the chamber and said in a slightly louder voice,
I am here to ask you, Hippotas.
Then he stopped, wincing as a headache pulsed through his skull and rubbed his forehead. Orso looked at him.
Yes,
he said. Gregor took a deep breath.
I'm sorry.
Take your time.
He swallowed and tried to collect himself, but the headache persisted.
Does that go away?
No.
Orso was smiling unpleasantly.
Never been near a lexicon before?
I have, but this one seems very...
big?
Yes, big. The machine is off, isn't it? I mean, that's the problem, correct?
Orso scoffed and turned to stare at the device behind him.
Right now, it is not off, as you put it. The more accurate term is reduced. It's difficult to turn a lexicon just off. It's not a damned windmill. It's a collection of assertions about physics and reality. Turning it off would be like, converting a striper into all the carbon and calcium and nitrogen and whatever else makes it up. Conceptually feasible, Sure, why not? Practically possible, not scrumming likely.
I see, said Gregor, though in truth he was nowhere close to seeing.
Orso's assistant exhaled softly, as if to say, here he goes again. Orso grinned at Gregor over his shoulder.
Want to come closer? Take a look?
Gregor knew Orso was goading him. The closer you got to a lexicon, the more uncomfortable it felt. But Gregor wanted to put Orso's guard down, however he could. And allowing himself to be toyed with was one option. Squinting in pain, he walked over to the glass wall and looked in at the lexicon. It resembled a huge metal can lying on its side. Only the can had been cut into tiny slivers or discs, thousands of them, or maybe even millions. He knew, in vague terms, that each disc was full of scribing definitions. The instructions or arguments that convinced scribed devices to work the way they ought to. Though he was aware that he understood this to about the same degree that he understood that his brain was what did all his thinking for him.
I've never seen one this close before, said Gregor. Almost no one has, said Orso. The stress of all that meaning, forcing reality to comply with so many arguments. It makes the thing hot as hell, and damned difficult to be around. And yet, last night, this device, all its assertions about reality, went poof and turned off, like blowing out a damned candle, which, as I have just generously described to you, ought to be impossible.
How? Asked Gregor.
Beats the ever-living shit out of me, said Orso with savage cheer.
He joined the girl at the scribing blocks and watched as she plugged in strings one after the other, the tiny metal cubes flying in and out as her fingers danced over the tray with blinding speed. Each time, a tiny glass at the top of the tiles would glow softly.
Now all kinds of goddamn strings work, he said. They work perfectly, implacably, and inarguably. How comforting. It's like the whole thing never happened.
I see, said Gregor. And may I ask, who is this exactly?
He nodded at the girl.
Her?
Orso seemed surprised by the question.
She's my fab.
Gregor did not know what a fab was, and the girl seemed uninterested in answering, ignoring them as she tested string after string of sigils. He decided to move on.
Was it sabotage? He asked. Another merchant house?
Again, beats the ever-living shit out of me, said Orso. I've checked all the infrastructural scrivings that keep the thing afloat, and those strings are all working away, cheery as can be. The lexicon itself doesn't show any damage. It shows no sign of having been properly or improperly reduced. If the dumb piece of shit who's in charge of maintenance could confirm the thing's regularly scheduled checkups, I could rule that out. And the tiles are all arranged in some pretty basic, boring, conventional configurations, right?
His assistant nodded. Correct, sir. She gestured to the walls behind her. Manufacturing, security, lighting, and transport. That's the extent of the wall's load. Gregor looked at the walls and slowly realized what she meant. The wall was the industry term for a tremendous wall of thousands of white tiles covered in sigils, which slid up or down on a short track. Each tile represented a scribing definition. If the tile was in the up position, the definition was inactive, and thus did not work. If it was in the down position, then it did. This sounded simple, but only a scriver with decades of high-level training could look at a wall and tell exactly what was going on. A lexicon's wall, of course, was carefully watched and maintained. If someone slid the wrong tile up and deactivated a crucial definition, It could, say, render all the scribed carriages in the Dandolo Campo suddenly unable to stop, which would be bad. Or if someone slid several critical tiles down and activated some extremely complicated definitions, then it could overload the lexicon and then, well, that would be much, much worse. Because a lexicon was essentially a giant violation of reality. That was why it was so unpleasant to be close to one. The consequences of a lexicon going haywire were too horrific to contemplate. And this was the chief reason that the city of Tavan, with all of its power, corruption, and fractious merchant houses, had yet to experience much deliberate turmoil, as the entire city was essentially maintained by a system of huge bombs that tended to make people cautious.
How troublesome, said Gregor.
Yes, isn't it?
Orso peered at him suspiciously.
Doesn't your mother know all this? I thought I'd been a good boy and properly kept her up to date.
I cannot speak to my mother's knowledge regarding your situation here, Hippotas, said Gregor. I'm not here about the blackouts. Rather, I had a question for you regarding the waterfront.
The waterfront? Said Orso, irritated. Why the hell would you bother me about that?
I wanted to ask you about the theft that took place.
What a waste of time! You can't expect me to—
He paused.
Wait. Theft? You mean the fire?
No, no, said Gregor politely. I mean the theft. Our investigations suggest that the fire was set as a distraction to allow a thief to get at our safes.
How do you know that? He demanded.
Because we have looked in our safes, said Gregor, and found something missing.
Orso blinked, very slowly.
Ah,
he said. He was quiet for a moment.
I had thought the safes burned down along with the Water Watch headquarters. I thought they were destroyed.
That was nearly the case, said Gregor. But when it became clear that the fire would spread, I had all of our safes loaded on carts and removed to safety.
Again, Orso blinked.
Really?
Yes, said Gregor. And we found something was stolen. A small, plain wooden box from safe 23D.
Orso and his assistant had gone very, very still. Gregor could not help but feel pleased.
It's nice to be right sometimes. Odd, said Orso carefully. But you said you had a question for me, and I've yet to hear a question, Captain. Well, I did some follow-ups in the commons last night, trying to track down the thief. I located their fence, the person who sells the things a thief steals, and found a note in their belongings referencing the Dandolo Hippotas in relation to this theft and fire. My question, Hippotas, would be, why do you think that is?
I've no idea.
The man's face, which had previously been riddled with contempt, impatience, and suspicion, was now perfectly bereft of almost all emotion.
You think I commissioned the theft, Captain?
I think little so far, because I know little so far, sir.
You could have been the person who was robbed.
Orso smirked.
You think someone stole scribing definitions from me?
A diversion, but Gregor was willing to be diverted for a bit.
Well, they are the most valuable thing in Tavan, usually, and they can be quite small, sir. They can be. That's true.
Orso stood, walked over to a shelf, pulled out three huge tomes, each about 7 inches thick, and walked back over to Gregor.
Do you see these, Captain?
I do.
Orso dropped one on the ground, and it made a large thud.
That is the opening definition for reducing a lexicon.
Then the second, which also made a huge thud.
This is a continuation of that definition.
He dropped the third.
And that is the closing definition for reducing a lexicon. Do you know how I know that? Because I wrote them, Captain. I wrote every sigil and every string in those big goddamn books.
He stepped closer.
A scribing definition might have fit in a small box, but not one of mine.
It was a good performance. Gregor was almost impressed.
I see, sir. And nothing else was stolen from you?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, then, I suppose the fence made the note concerning you by accident, perhaps.
Or you misread it, said Orso.
Gregor nodded.
Or that. We shall find out soon, I believe.
Soon? Why?
Well, I think I am close to catching the thief, and unless my instincts are incorrect, I think that their arrangements to sell what was stolen have gone quite wrong, which means they might still have what was stolen. So we might soon find it and get to the bottom of all this.
He smiled broadly at Orso,
which I'm sure we all find reassuring.
Orso was perfectly frozen now. The man was barely breathing. Then he said,
Yes, we certainly do, I'm sure.
Yes.
Gregor looked at the grand machine behind him.
Is it true what they say about lexicons and the hierophants, sir?
What? Said Orso, startled.
About the hierophants. I've heard old stories about how when people were close to a true hierophant, like Crasides the Great himself, they suffered from powerful migraines, much like how one feels these days when close to a lexicon. Is that true, sir?
How should I know?
I understand that you're interested in the Occidentals yourself, yes?
Asked Gregor.
Or you were, once.
Orso glared at him, and the severity of his harsh, pale eyes rivaled Ophelia Dandolo's stare.
Once, yes, but no longer.
For a moment, the two men just stared at each other. Gregor smiling placidly. Orso's face fixed in a furious glare.
Now, said Orso, if you will excuse us, Captain.
Of course. I will let you get back to your business, sir, said Gregor. Sorry to trouble you.
He started toward the steps, but paused.
Oh, I'm sorry, but... Young lady?
The girl looked up. Yes?
I apologize, but I believe I have been quite rude. I don't think I ever learned your name.
Oh, it's Grimaldi.
Thank you, but I meant your first name.
She glanced at Orso, but he still had his back to her. Berenice, she said. Gregor smiled.
Thank you. It was nice meeting you both.
Then he turned and trotted up the stairs. Orso Ignacio listened as the captain's footfalls faded. Then he and Berenice turned to look at each other.
Sir, said Berenice.
Orso shook his head and lifted a finger to his lips. He pointed at the various hallways and doors leading out of the lexicon chamber, then pointed to his ears.
Could be people listening.
She nodded.
Workshop?
She asked.
Workshop.
He said. They exited the lexicon chamber, called a carriage, and rode back to the Apatis department of the Inner Dandolo Enclaves, a sprawling, rambling structure that somewhat resembled a university. Orso and Berenice walked in, then silently climbed the stairs to Orso's workshop. The thick, heavy wooden door felt Orso coming and began opening. He'd scribed it to sense his blood. A deviously difficult trick. But he was impatient,
and shoved it open the rest of the way. He waited for the door to shut after him. Then he exploded.
"Shit! Shit! Shit!" he screamed.
"Ah," said Berenice. "Yes, I agree, sir."
I thought the goddamn thing had been destroyed," cried Orso, "along with the rest of the goddamn waterfront. But it was stolen? Again? I've been robbed again?"
"It would seem so, sir," said Berenice.
"But how? We kept it between us, Berenice. We only discussed it in this room. How did someone find out again?"
"That is concerning, sir," said Berenice.
"Concerning? It's a hell of a lot more than
"True, sir. But the larger question is..." She glanced at him, anxious. "What happens if Captain Dandolo does as he suggested and catches this thief tonight, and they still have the item in their possession?"
Orso went pale.
"Then when he brings the thief back, Ophelia will find out."
"Yes, sir."
"She'll find out that I paid for another expedition, another artifact."
"Yes, sir."
"And she'll find out how I paid for it, and how much."
Orso grabbed the sides of his head.
"Oh, God! All the thousands of devots I took, all that money I took, all that money I arranged, and the ledger's just right!"
She nodded. "That is my concern, sir."
"Shit!" said Orso, pacing. "Shit! Shit! We have to...
He looked at her.
"You have to follow him."
"I beg your pardon, sir."
"Follow him," said Orso. "You have to follow him, Berenice."
"Me, sir?"
"Yes."
He ran to a cabinet and grabbed a small box.
"He can't have left yet. Gregor Dandolo walks all over the campo like an idiot. Ophelia complains about it all the time. Grab a carriage, go to the southern gates, wait for him, and follow him. And..."
He fumbled with the box, frantic, and snatched something out of it.
"Take this."
He shoved what appeared to be a small, scribed strip of tin into her hands, with small tabs at the top and the bottom.
"A twinned plate, sir?" she asked.
"Yes,"
he said.
"I'll keep its pair. Let's see. Snap off the top tab if Gregor catches the thief. Snap off the bottom if he doesn't. And snap off both if he catches them and they still have the artifact. If the thief gets away, follow them if you can, and find out where they are. Whatever you do, the same thing will happen to my plate, so I'll know exactly what's happened."
"And you will stay here and do what exactly, sir?"
"There are favors I can call in," said Orso. "Debts people owe me, so that I can maybe cover up my own debts to the goddamn company. If Gregor Dandolo comes back here with that key, I need to make it look like I put just a toe out of line, not my old damn body and 30,000 scrumming devots of Dandolo chartered money."
"And you plan to arrange all that in..." She glanced out the open workshop window at the Michiel clock tower. 8 hours?
"Yes," he said. "But it would certainly be nice if Gregor Dandolo didn't bring the thief back here, so then I'd never have to do this at all."
"I hesitate to say this, sir," she said, "but I'm surprised that you aren't asking me to interfere with the captain's efforts and make sure the thief gets away. Then Ophelia would never know."
He paused.
"Gets away? Gets away? Berenice! That key could change everything, everything we know about scrying. There's almost nothing I wouldn't do to get it. If I've got to let Ophelia Dandolo cane me raw, so be it. I just don't want her tossing me in the Campo prison and keeping it for herself. And..."
His face slowly twisted into an expression of pure, murderous rage.
"And I certainly wouldn't mind getting a hold of that damned thief, who has humiliated me not once, but twice, and seeing them dismembered right in front of my scrumming nose, either."
Chapter 11.
So now what?
Asked Clef. Seated on the edge of a Michiel rooftop, just downwind from the foundries, Sanchia tried to shrug, and found she didn't have the spirit. I don't know. Survive, I suppose? Maybe steal some food out of a Campo's trash for dinner?
You'd eat out of the trash?
Yeah, have before, probably will again.
The jungles to the west look very tropical. Maybe you could hide out there for a while.
There are wild pigs as tall as a man's eye. Apparently, they enjoy killing people for sport. Not sure a magic key could be of much help there.
Okay, but this is a giant city, right? You can't find anywhere to hide? Anywhere?
Boundary Side and the Greens aren't safe. Maybe I could go to the Commons in the north, away from the channel. But the Commons only occupies about a tenth of Tavon's land. The rest of the city is Campo, and it's damn hard to hide there.
We're pulling it off now, said Clef.
For now, on a rooftop, yes. But this isn't exactly a sustainable arrangement.
Okay, so what? What's the plan?
Sanchia thought about it. Claudia and Giovanni mentioned that the Candianos changed up their sachets.
The who?
The Candianos, one of the four merchant houses. She pointed north. See that big dome out there?
Like the really, really, really big one?
Yes, that's the mountain of the Candianos. They used to be the most powerful merchant house in the world until Tribuno Candiano went insane.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned him. They locked him in a tower, right?
Supposedly. Anyways, Claudia said they changed their entire sachets up overnight, and no one does that unless something's gone really wrong. It means chaos and confusion somewhere on the Campo, and it's easiest to steal things during chaos and confusion. She sighed. But it'd need to be something big to get us the cash we need.
Why not rob that mountain place? It looks like it's full of valuable stuff.
She laughed lowly. Yeah, no. No one, and I mean no one, has ever broken into the mountain. You couldn't break into that place even if you had the wand of Crisides himself. I hear weird rumors about the mountain, that it's haunted or, well, something worse.
So what are you going to do?
Figure it out, however I can. She yawned, stretched out, and lay down on the flat stone roof. We have a few hours until sunset. I'm going to rest until then.
What? You're going to sleep on a stone roof?
Yeah, what's wrong with that? Clef paused.
I get the sense, kid, that you've lived in some rough places.
Sanchia lay on the roof, staring up at the sky. She thought about Sark, about her apartment, which, as barren as it was, now seemed like a paradise to her. Talk to me, Clef, she said.
Huh? About what?
Anything, anything, besides what's going on right now.
I see.
He thought about it.
Well, there are 37 scryvings currently active within a 1,000-foot radius of us. 14 of those are interrelated, actively engaged with each other, feeding information or heat or energy back and forth.
His voice grew soft, and a sing-song cadence crept into it.
I wish you could see them as I see them. The ones below us are dancing in a way, seesawing back and forth ever so gently as one hands off heat into a giant block of dense stone, storing it deep in its bones, while another scrying scoops it up and spills the heat across a plate of glass beads, softening them, melting them, until they form a plate of clearest glass. There's a scribed light on in a bedroom across the street from us. Its light is rosy and soft. Its scrying stored up all this old candlelight, and now they're slowly letting it leak out a dribble at a time. The light is bouncing very softly. Something's jostling it. I think a couple is making love on a nearby bed, perhaps. Imagine it, These people sharing their love in light that could be days, weeks, even years old. It's like making love under starlight, isn't it?
Sanchia listened to his voice, her eyelids growing heavy. She was glad to have him here. He was a friend when she had none.
I wish you could see them as I do, Sanchia, he whispered. To me, they're like stars in my mind.
She slept. Sanchia did not dream anymore after the operation. Yet sometimes when she slept, her memories returned to her, like bones bubbling up from the depths of a tar pit. There, on the roof, Sanchia slept and remembered. She remembered the hot sun of the plantations, the bite and slash of the sugarcane leaves. She remembered the taste of old bread and the swarms of stinging flies and the tiny hard cots in the shoddy huts. She remembered the smell of shit and urine festering in an open pit mere yards from where they slept, the sound of whimpering and weeping at night, the panicked cries from the woods as the guards hauled away a woman or sometimes a man and did as they pleased with them. And she remembered the house on the hill behind the plantation house where the fancy men from Tavan had worked. She remembered the wagon that had trundled away from the house on the hill every day at dusk. And she remembered how the flies had followed that wagon so closely, its contents hidden beneath a thick tarp. It hadn't taken long for everyone to realize what was happening. One night, a slave would simply vanish. The next day, the wagon would trundle away from the house on the hill, a horrid reek following it. Some had whispered that the missing slaves had escaped, but everyone had known this was a lie. Everyone had understood what was happening. Everyone knew about the screams they heard from the house on the hill, always at midnight. Always, always, always at midnight, every night. Yet they'd been voiceless and helpless. Though they'd outnumbered the Tavanis 8-1 on the island, the Tavanis bore armaments of terrifying power. They'd seen what happened when a slave raised a hand against their master and wanted no part of it. One night she'd tried to run away. They'd caught her easily. And perhaps because she'd tried to run away, they'd decided that she would be next. Sanchia remembered how the house had smelled. Alcohol and preservatives and putrefaction. She remembered the white marble table in the middle of the basement, its shackles for her wrists and ankles, the thin metal plates on the walls, covered with strange symbols, and the bright, sharp screws paired with them. And she remembered the man down in that basement, short and thin and one eye just a blank socket. And she remembered how he was always dabbing at his brow, wiping away sweat. She remembered how he'd looked at her and smiled and wearily said,
"Well, let's see if this one works, then."
That had been the first scriver Sanchia had ever met. She often remembered these things when she slept. And whenever she did, two things happened. The first was that the scar on the side of her head would ache as if it were not a scar, but a brand. And the second was that she forced herself to remember the one memory that made her feel safe. Sanchia remembered how everything had burned. It was dark when she awoke. The first thing she did was slip her fingers out of her glove and touch the roof of the foundry. The roof lit up in her mind. She felt the smoke coiling across it, felt the rain puddling at the base of the stacks, felt her own body, tiny and insignificant, pressing against its huge stone skin. But most important, she felt she was alone. No one up here but her and Clef. She started moving. She stood up, yawned, and rubbed her eyes.
"Morning," said Clef. "Or should I say good eve?"
There was a sharp crack from somewhere in the distance. Then something slammed into her knees, hard. Sanchia toppled over, crying out in surprise. As she did,
She looked down and saw a strange, silvery rope was looping around her shins like a snare. She dimly realized that someone out on the rooftops across from her had hurled